I would ask Pat, do we have any online questions at the moment? One? Dr. Pierce, are you ready to field that one? Okay, well, we do have our first question, and Dr. Pierce is our representative to the Dogfish Committee in the MID. I don't know if you want to try that or if there's anybody on staff who would like to attempt that. Paul? Paul, would you?
Mr. Chairman, could we read the question?
What?
Who is that masked man? James Fletcher, yes. This is a question that he's asked a number of times, not exactly in this context. I would think that we would not be in a position to consider recommending to the Secretary of Commerce that under the interim rule, that is the interim rule that was just proposed by the service regarding Gulf of Maine cod, that we would be able to jump over from Gulf of Maine cod to deal with a male dogfish fishery of some amount that would reflect some allowable take from a biomass of 300 to 900,000 metric tons, if indeed that is correct. So I just don't think it – I can turn to the center, of course. George, is there something that could be done? I don't think it can be done. I know there's been efforts by the Mid-Atlantic Council and maybe even this council to consider having a male-only fishery, but that hasn't – been moved forward as far as I know.
George Darcy.
I suspect he's talking generically about an interim rule rather than the Gulf of Maine cod interim rule. But in any case, that interim rule authority would be dammed over fishing, so that wouldn't be the appropriate way to accomplish this in any case. Yes, certainly the Mid-Atlantic Council, and I think this council, too, because it's a joint plan, has discussed this option for a number of years, and no one has been able to identify a way to have a male-only dogfish fishery, so far as I know. I think the Mid-Atlantic Council also, early in development of Amendment 3, that you're going to be talking about later in this agenda, considered that early on as a potential measure, and they dropped that because they didn't see any way to accomplish it. So that's what I know.
Phil?
Yes, I can't speak to whether the council would consider this or not, but I'll tip my hand a little bit about the Dogfish Amendment 3 presentation. One of the alternatives with regard to the research set-aside proposal for dogfish, their plans generally carve out 3% for research set-aside, but the FMAT recommended a 5% set-aside for dogfish research because the male dogfish biomass offers the potential for an increased targeting of that population. They didn't go into how that would be done or anything, but that's one angle that's being proposed to actually create some fishery in that regard.
Jim Adler.
I'm just thinking here of a mechanism, and I remember in the red crab fisheries, they got an experimental fisheries to harvest just male-only crab. or females, one of the other, to look into that because, male only because they had a female catch. So I'm just wondering if there would be a way to, for somebody like Mr. Fletcher to request an experimental fisheries on a certain amount of male dogfish to see if they can try to develop it that way.
Anyone else on this one? Dave Gason.
Yeah. Do we know right now what percentage of the current catch is male? What percentage of the current landings are male? Do we have any?
Less than
5%. Less than 5%. So, I mean, you could work it the other way if you have a 30 million pound, basically a 27.5 million pound female quota, and you could figure out how many males you wanted to catch. You could set a quota that closes when the amount of females reaches 27.5 million, and let them fish for males as an example. I mean, it looked like if those numbers are correct, and I don't know if they are, that you could have a potentially a 60 million pound fishery on males, say something like that. And that would be a way forward. I mean, you give people incentive to go catch males, and they'll catch them. I guarantee it. And they'll catch a lot more males than females. They're not hard to catch. They tend to sort themselves out more or less by sex. More or less. That's why I asked the question about what percentage were currently males.
Laura.
I just wondered, George, going back to your comment, saying that this person probably was referring to it, not referring to the Gulf of Maine cod interim rule, but as we think about eco-based fishery management and we think about the fact that fishing isn't the only pressure on these stocks, that perhaps helping with an issue of predation, arguably dogfish running wild on juvenile cod, that perhaps it is something that should be considered as we try to solve the Gulf of Maine cod solution by increasing the catch of dogfish.
George Darcy.
Yeah, in the longer term, that is something that certainly can be discussed. I was referring to the mechanism here. An interim rule would not be the appropriate mechanism to do this. I don't think we'd even have legal authority to do it, and that train's left the station anyway. So I'm assuming he's talking about doing something more quickly than a typical council amendment through some other mechanism, but I could be wrong. I'm just making an assumption.
Anyone else on this one before we entertain another question? David Pierce.
Yeah, just very quickly. Phil made the point that perhaps the research set aside could somehow be used to provide the industry, or at least individuals who are willing to apply for a research set aside, to pursue this to see if indeed they could establish a fishery for male dogfish only. If there is one, I suspect it would be down in the mid-Atlantic area, not up here, because I know the sampling that we've done in Massachusetts in the ports on board the boats indicates that it varies dramatically. I mean, especially with it's a gillnet fishery, it's a hook fishery. You drop the gillnets, you drop the hooks, and you're going to get pretty much a mix. Most of the time it's females as opposed to males. With regard to a male fishery only, let's say down or as part of a research set aside, I guess the question would be for the processors, and that the male dogfish tend to be much smaller than the female dogfish. They might have less value, so there might not be a strong market for those smaller fish, especially since now we're looking at a quota of 35 million pounds. So the urgency for getting access to the male dogfish as an alternative to the larger females, I think, has diminished greatly. So, again, the processes need to be consulted by, and Mr. Fletcher, I suggest to see if, indeed, there would be an interest on their part to purchase those smaller and less valuable dogfish.
Thank you for that. Do we have a question from anybody in the audience or comment? Ron?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ron Smolowitz. Thanks again for the presentation that you gave me. I hit it, so you can't take it away now that I'll begin my rant and rave. I think everybody has a copy of this. I just labeled it ecosystem management. You know, we've always talked in the grand sense of ecosystem management. We always talk about it. We never do anything about it. And you know, ecosystem management means by area, whether it's a large marine ecosystem or a smaller ecosystem. And I was at that Southern New England Yellowtail workshop in Woods Hole. And one of the things about scallop management, or bycatch management, especially with projections, we need to be looking at smaller areas, and we need to know the biomass in smaller areas, while in general the assessment process looks at it, Southern New England Yellowtail. And that's not good enough at this stage for scallop management. Eventually, it's not going to be good enough for any of the other species. And one of the things, as they were going over reference points, they're looking at that single species, Southern New England Yellowtail. And Greg from SMAS had given a presentation about their survey that they did for Yellowtail, and about 250 stations. They had to throw out 30 stations because the biomass of dogfish was so large. So you have to sit there and you have to ask yourself, how could you ever bring back Yellowtail with an ecosystem just filled up with biomass of Elasma branches? And I was thinking in terms of skates at the time, but in here, they had a graphic of the historic levels of yellowtail abundance in southern New England. And it's way up here, you know, in the 50s and 60s, and now it's collapsed down to nothing. In this slide, I just took the index. And it's an overall index. It's not the index by survey strata. And then you look at little skates, and it's sort of the opposite. And I remember going out on yellowtail boats in the 70s. I don't remember doing anything other than putting yellowtail into baskets. I don't remember skates on deck. And I've checked with other guys. I hate to say I'm an old timer, but they agree. You know, the skates weren't there. So last week I was out testing a new dredge. And that's the data that's I put down in this table that says the low-profile dredge versus standard dredge. The New Bedford standard dredge there, these two dredges had the same bag because I was testing the frames. And this bag is a design that we're going to be using for the bycatch survey, the monthly bycatch survey on George's Bank to get better swept area estimates of flatfish. And it's built to retain the flatfish within commercial standards. But look at the skate catch, 10,000 skates and 50 tows, and these are 30-minute tows. It's order of magnitude more than anything else in that gear. There's no room for yellowtail. It's just not there. One of the things I just, in the scallop shell house frequencies, I just want to mention that while it looks like we had a slight reduction in scallop catch with that new experimental dredge, the fact of the matter is that it catches more larger scallops. It lets out the smaller scallops. It also, the new dredge design is very effective in reducing fish bycatch, but that's another subject. So the bottom line is, when I looked at the my catch rates and did back of the envelope comparisons with the surveys, the survey that we have now is not giving us a good representation of skates and flatfish, especially windowpane flounder. It's way off. So the first thing, I'm very concerned that our current survey strategies for flatfish and skates are just underestimating the actual abundance of those species out there, especially stocks that aren't landed as such as the windowpane. The second thing is, I don't see how you could have reference points and expect to achieve any objective when you're not even looking at the ecosystem is filled up with other biomass. And again, by area, we have to deal with smaller areas. We can't just deal with Southern New England Yellowtail. We have to divide that into much smaller areas. And And so I'm saying, what could be done now? And one of the things the council could do right now is just issue a terms of reference. And might have to be done on the fly and not to the level of high degree of science. But you should basically ask that yellowtail process, which is ongoing. It has a modeling session. Oh, and they're all busy. I know they're all busy. But just say, hey, what is the biomass of elasma branches in the southern New England area that you're looking at? I mean, Jim Fletcher is sort of the opening shot here, but... And just say, okay, given that we have this huge biomass there, how could that potentially affect the rebuilding of the southern New England yellowtail? Just ask them, even if it's not done quantitatively, qualitatively, get some answers back from these folks. Start getting people to focus on the fact that there's this ungodly amount of skates and dogfish in the area where we're trying to rebuild stocks. And so I just see the buck being passed from, I go to council meetings, I go to science center meetings, they say, well, it's not in the terms of reference, the council should have given us in the terms of reference. I come back here, you know, it's too many things on the table, we can't overload the scientists. But we have a real issue here. And you guys know, I don't even have to summarize it. You know what the issue is. I think we have to start looking at the fact that we have a totally screwed up ecosystem out there. And if it means that this is the place that it starts, the bottom up, to go right up to Congress, to tell them the idea that trying to maintain all stocks at high levels of abundance is just ecologically impossible, and they better reconsider the tools available, then let it start here. Okay, let's start doing it now, instead of passing the buck and not responding. That's my banter. Thank you.
Mary Beth.
So my understanding is that the terms of reference for the Southern New England Yellowtail Stock Assessment have already been set, and I don't know if recently there was a stock assessment workshop, and I think they just concluded a data workshop, so they haven't got as far as the stock assessment workshop. So I guess I just asked for some feedback from the Science Center to what extent the council could ask for consideration of Ron's request at this point. Jim has his hand up.
Dr. Weinberg.
Thank you. I got tipped off a little bit that Tom was going to raise this issue. I mean, I'm sorry, that Ron was going to raise this issue. And Larry Alade, who's the lead assessment scientist, went and looked at our database already to examine for the Southern New England Yellowtail assessment how much data was in the food habits database in order to try to get a finer estimate of predation mortality on Southern New England Yellowtail. And the message that he conveyed back to us that the Southern New England Yellowtail flounder in the stomachs are apparently there are not very many records that are recorded to species. The identification of flounder in stomachs is difficult to do to species. So the lead assessment scientist indicated that it would be difficult to split this out to fine-tune the natural mortality rate due to predation. So I'm sure that Ron is making a valid point about the large number of elasmobranchs that are out there. I'm not sure what the working group will be able to do with that other than to document the inverse relationship that Ron has described qualitatively for you. So I'm sure the working group could consider this as a possible term of reference, but I'm not sure how fruitful it will be. And in addition, as he said, the working group is very busy. They have quite a long list of terms of reference that they are working on, and those terms of reference were approved by the NRCC about 4 months ago, and that went through the whole process of getting public input and NRCC approval, and then getting it to the working group in time for them to do their work. So that's all I have to add to this.
Tom Dempsey.
Great, thanks. I think the place to incorporate the impacts of dogfish is in the assessment of dogfish, of that stock, and the management advice that would come out of that. I think Ron is spot on in the impacts of the biomass dogfish that we have right now, not just on yellowtail flounder, not just on George's Bank cod, but on a number of these stocks. But I think that the obvious place to, in my mind, to incorporate that is in the dogfish assessment and then the management advice that comes out of that. I don't know how we'd get at it, especially at this point, as Jim pointed out, with the yellowtail assessment. But I think we definitely need to pursue that. I think it's a huge problem, and I do think that we continue to under-categorize or underestimate the impacts of that stock on other things because of some of the issues associated with stomach sampling and diet sampling and the poor information that we have. And we know they're eating something. And I just think that we need to continue to pursue that at an EBFM level using the tools that we have already. And I guess my question, and it's a very short one, is when's the next dogfish assessment plan? When do we anticipate that?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear your question. Paul was asking me a question.
I was just wondering if there's a new dogfish assessment planned in the next few years.
Dr. Weinberg.
No, there is no dogfish assessment currently planned. There are updates that are done in various forms as assessment updates or reference point improvements that have been done annually, but no benchmark assessment is currently scheduled.
Dave Gayton.
I think Ron's question is much larger than that. I really do. And I think we're falling into the, in this case, dueling single species issues. There's a book for sale right down the road here at the Mystic Seaport that details the life of a fisherman out of a Connecticut port here back in the, from the early 1900s to the early 1950s, I guess. And part of that study is he did some original cooperative research where he took some people from Yale who came down and said that we had, in the, I believe it was 40s, determined that there was an inverse relationship between little skate and winter flounder. When little skate populations were high, winter flounder populations were low. And, all this work seems to have been forgotten in the last 20 years as we've moved into this single species tunnel vision type program. And I think Ron is exactly right. I mean, I think Congress, somebody needs to get off the dime here and tell Congress in no uncertain terms that single species management doesn't work. You have to manage the system, not the species. If you manage the system, the species will take care of themselves. And we've managed to get everything out of whack here entirely with single species management. We get more little skates, you get out and walk on the things. You can't have all these little skates carpeted at the bottom where the yellowtail and the blackback live. It's that simple. But, we can't deal with that because we got to keep little skates at maximum sustainable yield. We can't even consider it. So I think Ron has raised an important question. I think the question that this council should be asking is how do we get that information well beyond this council, whether the service carries the message or... we have to do it as individuals, but we need, that message has to be conveyed, that we are reaping exactly what we sowed here with single species management, and it's not a pretty picture.
Other comments on this, or should we get another question? I see Chris, and then I got Kevin. Chris, you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Christopher Brown, the Rhode Island Commercial Fishermen Association. I don't know where to start. I was going to talk about a new fishery, but I'm going to jump on the dogfish bandwagon briefly. I have no choice. I just concluded a year-long study on dogfish with Dr. James Sulikowski, University of New England. At the end of the year, we determined that it's entirely possible that the biological information on dogfish that is being currently used by the National Marine Fisheries Service, NOAA, Woods Hole, is so outdated that it's potentially responsible for underestimating the biomass 3- to 10-fold. Dogfish reproduce 3 or 4 months more frequently than is currently being used. Their diet consists of bony fish. I think it was 70% bony fish is being used, and we found that 98% of their diet is bony fish. In the Gulf of Maine, it was determined that over the course of the year, 10% of the content of the dogfish stomachs was juvenile cod. They compete directly for forage with adult cod, and then they eat the babies when they're not looking. It's entirely possible, according to Dr. Sulikowski, that it is physically impossible to have any significant recovery of Gulf of Maine cod without first removing dogfish. Fishermen are not particularly wedded to catching one fish or another. They're wedded to paying their bills and making money. Part of the codfish solution is going to be the removal of dogfish. It just makes too much sense that we have to take something out in order to grow something. If we are ever going to go down this road to ecosystem management, we're going to have to become architects and engineers of a more productive ecosystem. We have to be able to take the first step. If every time a fisherman looked over the stern of a boat and saw a net full of dogfish, if that was a scientific observation as opposed to a point of data on a vessel trip report, we would have an entirely different opinion of how many dogs are in the ocean. So, like I said, I came up with the intention of talking about a different fishery, but the dogfish thing is just such low-hanging fruit, and it is so important that we have to do everything we can to get that stock assessment right. Unfortunately, the politics of the science that drives this management mechanism isn't good. The new breed of ecosystem engineers and energetic scientists are not well received by the population dynamics dinosaurs that are roaming the earth. That's all there is to it. These kids can't get a word in edgewise. They get kicked to the curb. These guys are smart. They are deserving of having an opportunity to have a say in the outcome of this process. There is no solution in the camp of population dynamics to the problems that we have. The pop-down guys only tell you how to ratchet up or ratchet down specific landing levels on single species. They never complete their sentences. They may know that you have to take dogfish out of the system before you can grow cod, but they never talk of it. The ecosystem guys, the young guys, the new kids, they get it. We have worked ourselves into a perfect corner. There is no solution to the Gulf of Maine cod problem that doesn't take overfishing as a first step and then commercial eradication as a second. We have to start thinking about things differently. We have to become architects and engineers of a more productive system. So I would encourage you to make room for these kids and let them into the conversation so that they can render a solution that we can all live with. Thank you.
Anybody care to make a comment on that? Paul?
Okay. I guess I'm Paul Rago. I guess I am one of the dinosaurs. But I have invited the new mammals into the den, and I have a meeting scheduled with Jim Sulikowski to talk about this. So, you know, one of the most important parts was the change in the gestation period, and so we will be talking about that, and as well as other aspects of Jim's research. I guess maybe one comment on in terms of the tools that are available. One of the best tools available is to put species like this in the bottom of a boat and sell them. And there is both the skate and the dogfish quotas have increased in recent years, and in selling them for money and making profit is a very valuable exercise. So there are tools available for that, even within the context of the dogfish. I mean, other in the context of population dynamics. Thank you.
Bill Carr.
If I may just add a little bit, clearly various people have spoken to the statutory discouragement of moving more directly into ecosystem-based fisheries management. Of course, that's not the only reason that we can't move there, because the ecosystems are remarkably complex. And we're learning more, and we are moving slowly in that direction, and I think the Council has actually taken some very strong steps to support that in the work that's being done through our ecosystem processes, people at the Science Center, and in collaboration with the broader scientific community. But we are seeing a lot of changes taking place in the ecosystem, and so the way that we connect the dots is obviously very, very important here. And while it's clear that there's a very large population of dogfish out there, it's clear that they're voracious, and it's clear that they do eat cod, it's not necessarily clear that by removing the dogfish we're going to automatically create changes in the ecosystem which are going to favor cod. So we really have to look much more broadly, and that's what the ecosystem approach means. It means looking more broadly and bringing all the information that we have to bear in understanding what's going on and how it affects the productivity of the individual fish species, and not just to look at what may be attractive and potentially maybe worthwhile solutions one at a time.
Thank you. I'm going to jump to Kevin. Did you write your hand up?
Thank you very much. Is it? It's all right to speak on scallops? Yeah, with this? Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Thank you for letting me speak. I'd like to talk about the scallop resource and the surveys, kind of a follow-up to Dr. Rego's presentation. And I do have a couple of slides to back up my statements if you want to see them. I don't know if that's appropriate or not, but if it is, I have it on a zip disk and can give them. Do you want to see them or no?
Yeah, I was thinking we're actually going back to a discussion at 5 o'clock on HABCAM and getting Dr. Rego back up. Maybe it's more works better at that point in time.
However you would like to plan.
Well, because that's focused on that issue that we had, and
it is, yeah.
Yeah. So, if it's okay with you, let's do that. We'll try and take one more question and wrap up the listening session and go back to the HABCAM question.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Kevin. Jim.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jim Kendall, New Bedford Seafood Consulting. You know, I know I'm getting older and I'm getting more forgetful, but I can't imagine, or I can't get over, how many of you are doing the same thing. I can't help but think back to the night or the day that we had the discussion and started the management of dogfish. And at the time, we had a presentation from our scientist, whether it was Thomas, what dire straits dogfish were in. And one of the reasons was the fact that their gestation periods were so long. And, you know, while they spawned regularly, it was a long stretch for these various gestation periods. Now, one of the facts that came up at that time, and I raised the issue following that because I was on the council at that point, was the fact that they could be going through two gestation cycles at the same time, one at one level and one perhaps at half that rate. So in other words, in that 18-month period or whatever the period was that they were claiming dogfish reproduced at, there was actually two going on. So now that tends to make me think that we were doubling that resource rather than cutting it in a third by having such a long period of gestation. And yet today it's coming up that, gee, they found out they reproduce at a quicker rate. We knew this 12, 13, 14 years ago. And now it's just being borne out. We wonder why we have problems. Fishermen have been telling you this, that there's a lot more dogfish out there. You're not looking in the right places for the big dogfish, so you miss them. And then you had someone at the same time turn around and say, good, now we'll get this resource to ourselves. So there was a hidden agenda in there someplace, because I actually heard that saying that we'll get the markets to ourselves. We'll get rid of the big dealers, which we had in New Bedford, and which perturbed me to no end to hear someone say this, that they'll get this and hold it for their own. So I don't think that it was throughout the whole regime at that point in time that someone was trying to scam the rest of us out of this. But look at the damage that's been caused and how are we going to rectify it. We've got to recognize it before we can fix it. Thank you.
Anyone got a comment on that? Yeah. Chris, is that to that? Okay. I just wanted to see what...
Thank you for letting me back up after calling everybody a dinosaur. In the year 2013, this commercial industry is going to have to bear the load economically of paying for observer coverage to some extent. To what extent that is, we don't know, but we know it is going to be a little, and it's going to be a little more the year after that, a little more the year after that. What I'm here to ask is that we start to consider the possibility of mixed mesh fisheries being observed and prosecuted so that we no longer are exclusively dependent on groundfish when we leave the harbor. Years ago, we would go fishing, and we would fish for flatfish for a couple of days, and then we would fish for whiting on the way home. Boats would come home with a lot of fish in them. Economically, it made a lot of sense. You caught two different things. They couldn't drop the price on you on both things, we always thought. Sometimes they did. So it seems to me that any institutional bias against that is a hangover from days at sea, and that we should be able to, when completely observed, be able to go fishing like we used to. We used to be able to go catch groundfish and then and switch over. If I have an observer and I am owning the mortality of my conduct, it makes only too much sense to give us the flexibility to go to sea with more options as opposed to less. Much as we thought we were going to be using our codfish quota to access groundfish, now it seems as if we're going to have to use our groundfish stocks to access whiting or redfish or shrimp, whatever. There is no visible means by which we can afford to pay for observer coverage in the year 2013 with the quotas where they are and where they are headed. We need to be creatively flexible at the council level, to abandon the belief that you can't do it, and create an incentive for people to except monitoring all the time. If you can make more money with a monitor by having the flexibility to set two different nets, then you have created an environment in which it'll be well received, and you will see some of the cleaner small mesh fisheries prosecuted responsibly and profitably. So we have to get that ball rolling, because 2013 is just around the corner in council terms. Thank you.
Anyone like to make a comment on that thought? Jim.
Well, I think Chris has a great point there in that, but I'm just trying to think of the mechanisms to allow that to move that kind of thinking to move forward. And I'm thinking that regulation is a groundfish regulation to prevent small mesh on a groundfish vessel. So the place for that to be dealt with would be in the groundfish, the multi-species FMP. And how you do that, I don't know yet. But that's think, narrowing it down to where it would have to be dealt with, that would be the place. And we've got several things happening in groundfish. I don't know if that could be considered in not the short-term future actions, but in one of the ones going forward later on.
Terry Stockwell, then Dave Preble.
Tomorrow afternoon, we're going to discuss several actions the committee, Groundfish Committee, has been working on since our last council meeting, one of which is a sector management framework that's focused on the monitoring issues. The second is the ABC framework, which I had only a little bit of work done to date. I'm not sure, and it'd probably be a question for Gene, and despite the fact that Tom will jump up and down because we're already up against the timeline for getting what we have on our work list to date, but what action would a proposal such as CRISP was outlining, could it be done in a framework, or would it need to be done in an amendment?
Well, how would you, all right, characterize his proposal to me?
Well, he was proposing to allow a small mesh on a groundfish trip. If it's in, as Jim laid out, in the groundfish regs, we would have to remove that prohibition from the groundfish regs.
I'm not. You're saying as an experiment or as a permanent across-the-board measure?
As a flexibility measure. I'm just thinking off the top of my head just to try to keep the conversation going.
Yeah, I mean, I'd have to have more information to know exactly what the purpose is, what the extent of it is. I mean, to me, it seems like a new concept that's not something that that's contemplated in the current FMP, and that it might be more appropriate for some sort of experimental fishery first as a pilot rather than just throwing it into a management program before knowing what you can anticipate the results might be.
Dave Preble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure I'd characterize it as a new concept. Traditionally, fishermen were able to move quickly from one fishery to another. And in fact, that's how small boat fisheries survived. I know I've got a copy of the 1872 legislative findings of the Commission of the State of Rhode Island that characterized the small boat fisheries at that time. And the chief characteristic of the small boat fisheries was that fishermen were able to move quickly from one fishery into another in order to maintain a steady stream of income, and that was 1872. So there's nothing new about the idea. It's actually very recently that we've gotten away from it. I remember my father saying that if a man's going to make a living on a small boat, he's going to be light on his feet for just that reason. And one of the things that we used as a justification for catch shares was the ability to go back to that kind of thinking. And I think we need to, I think we need to explore this. I think it's the right way to move. We've got to open up possibilities so that we're not having people out there burning fuel to catch one species We've got to give them that option. It only makes sense to do it. Thank you.
Maggie, did you have something to this?
Yes, thank you. We actually do have a mechanism that could allow what Chris is talking about. The council could endorse a sector exemption request to do that kind of fishing under trips that have observer coverage. It's precisely what the council did at your last meeting when I asked you to endorse our redfish exemption using a smaller mesh. So we do have a mechanism. You just have to be willing to make that recommendation to the agency that they would consider that kind of request. Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to wrap this up. Vito, you got something on?
Vito Calamo, representing the United States Senator Scott Brown. I have a lot of things, to be quite frank with you, and while we're on the subject, Dave Preble over there talking about his father, this is what I did. I carried two nets. I had a groundfish net and a whiting net, and if there was redfish, we'd figure out some way of using that net for redfish also. The sector management plan has destroyed the small boat fishery. And they're hanging on by their fingernails. I know you heard everybody tell you they're going out of business for years and they didn't go out, but they are thin. And we're destroying the infrastructure up and down the coast, which creates jobs, which my boss is in full swing on keeping jobs, creating jobs. And this, there are thousands of jobs in the balance. As far as paying for observer coverage, if you allow the fishing industry to pay for observer coverage under the magnitude that you're talking about, they will be gone. Absolutely gone. Can't handle it. Impossible. But since we have observer coverage that is paid by the government, what would be wrong with trying to use two nets, three nets, whatever the case may be? Dave Preble says, light on your feet. Well, about 150 pounds ago, I was light on my feet when I captained several vessels, and I fished with my dad and my grandfather, that we did switch nets, and it took a lot of manpower to do it. But today they have hydraulics and cranes and so on and so forth. It's not as hard. There are other plans in our minds, and we talk with Washington, and the chiefs come in and talk to me on, we need to be proactive, very proactive, working with management. It's very important, Mr. Chairman, that we do that. I may go off. You can shut me down if you want. You will not insult me if I go in too far, but I'm going to switch gears a little for you so I can get this in. I listened to the presentation about the HABCAM, same thing that SMAS has done for years. And I think that's absolutely a great presentation I listened to. I think it's absolutely fantastic, except for one thing that we're missing here. Bill, listen to me. We're going to take this relatively new unit that is the old process. They've worked together. I listened to the two science people. They've worked together hand in hand from SMAS. And why I know so much about SMAS, because I worked there for about four years as executive director working with SMAS in the University of Massachusetts and not Dartmouth. To take and not fund, like we have in the past, SMAS, to the point where it could be a backup system and a check and balance system to something that's relatively new to NOAA, I think we're making a mistake. I heard somebody say, well, what happens if this breaks down? Well, we'll go back to the old style. I don't think we should be doing that. I don't think it would take much funding. I think they have most of the funding, but I don't think it would take much funding, you know, maybe $300,000 to finish their season, but we should have them, especially this year. We should be backing SMAS, especially this year, And I talk to you, Bill, because that is probably one of the greatest partnerships I've ever seen between management, fishermen, and science. The New Bedford scallopers are number one in the world. They are the best. And they know what they're doing. I've been part of it. I've watched it with amazement, the joint partnership. And this is something that's being missed here. Not only are the fishermen in partnership, there are the people that sell the oil are in partnership. The people that sell the groceries that are in partnership. You talk about a joint collaboration of partnerships. I've never seen this in all my life. I've seen little ones, but this is in a large scale. In other words, the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker are all making money off of this scallop industry. And it's the number one in the country. I don't understand why we can't work with SMAS a little more and give them a little more funding that should be available for this kind of research. It's very important to United States Senator Scott Brown that we keep the ball rolling in the biggest money-producing fishery in the eastern seaboard. We do not want to end up with seven large fishing vessels. We want to end up with many fishing vessels, many jobs. I understand management overdoing it. There were hundreds of boats when I fished as a kid. I was so scared when I was a captain that I shook to try to get through the boats. Now it's a splintered fleet, but it's a good fleet. They're the best of the crop. We need to help keep them going. We must work together on this HABCAM, or SMAS's cam that they've had down below, their projection, their movie camera, their camera. I've seen it. I've watched it. I'm amazed. It's a win-win situation for everybody. And one more last thing, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. This will be my last. Is that I think all advisors should be told once again how to behave at some of these public meetings, because our meetings are public. Sometimes they get carried away a little. There's a code of conduct that you must abide by, and I think it needs to be reiterated to some of them. I hear some foul things at times because I attend different meetings, whether I'm an advisor or not. I attend meetings, and that's my job, working for United States Senator Scott Brown, because there's jobs, and jobs are very important in this country, and there are thousands of jobs out there related to the fishing industry, and that's where I come in. I want to keep jobs going. I want to keep the infrastructure going, and I want to keep you people going. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I think we will, with that, wrap up the listening session. Thank you all for comments. I think we had some very interesting ones, some interesting discussions. I think we've got a bunch of ideas to work on, and we'll look forward to doing this again at our next meeting. I would like to return now to Dr. Rago and the HABCAM discussion. Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I realize that you wanted to conclude this today at 5:30, so I'll be as quick as I can possibly be. I'd like to bring this to a head, if I may. I think the center is on a great job responding to 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 a great job